All right, welcome everybody. Thank you for being on time. Okay, she didn't get that. Okay, so I lowered the lights for dramatic effect, but also so that we could see our presentations that we're going to be doing here. If you are in your program, we are here for Understanding Sexual Abuse in Mormonism. My name is Rob Frey. I'll be your moderator for today's panel. We have three presenters here today. Deborah Jensen from Utah State University. Deborah? Yes, you can applaud. You can... Yes, that's what we wanted. Thank you, guys. And then we have Lisa Butterworth. And then from Dixie State University, we have Nancy Ross. And so they each have a presentation. They're going to go through each of their presentations. Once they're done with their presentations, that's the time where we're going to be taking questions. Now, when it comes to questions, what we're going to do is I'll have the microphone, and I can come to you, or if you want to come to me, either way. We want to stay within the timeline, so also very be respectful of other people's time. We want to make sure that our presenters get out on time and that you guys can be able to go to your next session. With that being said, we're going to have Deborah go ahead and start her presentation. Do you want the microphone while you do this, or I can change your slides for you?
I'm going to come up.
Sit down. Take that mic,
no, and I'll just.
Okay, here we go.
Sorry, I'm gonna take that. So.
Do you want to take the podium? Because this one doesn't.
Yeah, I'll just do this. This will make my life. I made that so much harder than it needed to be, but you know, if somebody tells me where to go, I usually say no. All right. So. Hi. I want to just start really quickly before I dive into my section. How much time do I have?
I would say 15.
Okay.
15.
I just want to make sure. All right. So I'm assuming that most of you sussed this out from the title of the panel, but we're going to be discussing sexual abuse, and I'm going to be reading excerpts from talks in general conference that cover that topic. So just like general self-care trigger warning, okay? When discussing this with some friends of mine, they were actually quite bothered by some of the things that were said in conference talks. I know you'll find that shocking. So I just wanted to make sure you know. So when we decided to put this panel together, I immediately took the easiest section, and I volunteered to look at the conference talks since 1971, basically everything that's available online, and try to understand better the way that our general authorities and general officers of the church speak about sexual abuse and assault. The fact that I didn't use the word assault originally should clue you in that they don't use that word either. So I did a qualitative analysis, a deep reading of those talks. I basically just stole the selection criteria to get my sample from Zelophehad's Daughters, the blog post that they did after the church issued the statement that said, we've spoken about this more than 30 times, and we're talking about this, and it's so important. And the method looked like this. We went to LDS.org, and we typed in abuse. And any conference talk that had that word in it, we looked at. That yielded 77 total talks, starting in April 1971 and all the way to April of 2014. 26 of those talks referred to sexual abuse and discussed it in some substantial way, made a comment specifically about it. Just because it would have been way too many Boyd K. Packer talks, I removed out of my sample anything that referred to self-abuse. Sorry. This is a really deep and heavy subject. It's going to get inappropriate just to keep me from crying. So I did a deep read trying to understand the language and message being sent in these talks. To give you a couple of numbers, because I do like numbers, of the 26 that really did talk about sexual abuse in some sort of substantial way, two of those talks were given by Elder Oaks, two were given by Elder Scott, two were given by President Monson, three were given by President Packer, and 7 were given by President Hinckley at some point. So across the sample, President Hinckley is the voice that we hear from the most. Only 2 talks were direct, 3 kind of, 2 from Elder Scott and 1 from President Hinckley, were directed specifically at this subject and this, you know, the population of survivors, which they refer to as victims, and occasionally perpetrators. So the larger themes that I found, I'm just going to walk you through them. The number one thing that seems to be discussed, and I wouldn't say number one as in it's the most common thing, but it seems to be the thing that gets wrapped up in the most, that gets wrapped up and tangled into almost everything when we talk about it, would be this institutional concern, protecting the institution. And this looks like, I mean, I would imagine you can probably guess what institutional concerns look like when we talk about sexual abuse in the church. It looks like discussing the responsibility that we have as priesthood leaders. We, not me. Spoiler alert. The ordained women panel is on Saturday morning. But this would be a quote from President Hinckley, where he's discussing the institutional responsibility of church leadership to address this issue. But then it's always, almost always comes back to this protection of, like, legal concerns, right? And that's, I would classify anything that references the hotline as a legal concern, as the church's attempt to protect themselves, saying, so that were they, I don't know, just, I mean, like, just, out, you know, like a wild, wild dream were a general authority to be, like, subpoenaed to speak in a case about this, that would never happen. Does nobody know that that's happening?
Yeah.
All right, cool. I was like, you guys are cool with this, right? We're all on the same page? But if that were to happen, this would be a perfect defense. Or they could point to these talks where they said, no, we've been telling our leaders, we have this hotline that's specifically designed to help them know how to handle this. Almost always institutional concern quotes come with, like, this idea of, like, a caveat. Like, we want you to, in extreme cases, you'll contact authorities. Or when appropriate, leaders should contact authorities. So we're already creating, like, grades of abuse instead of an automatic across the board. If someone comes to you with abuse, you should report it to authorities, which to me seems problematic. The next one would be this idea that it's tied to the institutional authority of priesthood. And oftentimes when we're talking about abuse, they're talking about no one who's ordained should do this. This is a pretty common one. A lot of the talks were given, especially from President Hinckley, were given during priesthood session, directed specifically at men. No one who has been ordained should do this. Anyone who has done this and is ordained is no longer allowed to use that authority and power. And that's strong, it's powerful language for our community, but it is still this idea of protecting the institution. And then the idea of institutional discipline is often mentioned as well. So we get the traditional, if you do this, you're going to be excommunicated. That's the message being sent in conference. It's outside the scope of my study to determine whether or not that is actually the way things happen. Additionally, there were also a couple of mentions of, like, President Hinckley got very specific and said things like, talked about the process. You'll be excommunicated, and we're going to put a star on your record, and you're not going to be allowed to have certain callings. And that was one talk that was at a priesthood session, really digging deep and telling, I'm almost walking these priesthood holders through the process and saying, this is what will happen or what you should be doing. So the institutional concern was a big, was really common. Second one would be this doctrinal idea, which everything the church does seems to fall in one of 2 categories, right? It's either institutional and policy or it's doctrine. And when they talk about this in a doctrinal way, they have these 3 interesting ways that they do this. The first one is they speak often about doctrine being preventative. Anyone who is disciplined enough and reading the scriptures and doing the things that they're supposed to, if they truly understand the doctrine, they would never do this. She's giggling. This is not funny. But it's this idea that it becomes sort of a faith test, right? Which if you want to dig a little bit deeper in what that message is, basically they're already shaming. Like, it would make it harder for you to be somebody to come forward if you were a perpetrator, which they call on you to do in several of these talks, because they're saying immediately that the reason you did this is because you're not close enough to the doctrine, you're not disciplined enough. They use the word discipline a lot. The second way that they use doctrine is they talk about it in the reparative way, in forgiveness specifically. Forgiveness is the most common doctrinal theme that appears. This is where it gets it gets inappropriate pretty quick here, because this is where the number one thing that we are telling victims or survivors is that forgiveness should be their goal, that forgiveness is required for healing, and that the doctrine, if you really understand the doctrine, you'll be able to heal and forgive. And that, as I'm sure we can all agree, is a problem. It's a message that puts tremendous guilt and blames victims for not being able to recover quickly enough or even ever, if we're using that as the, benchmark. And then the last one would be the doctrine of the eternal family comes up a lot in this, in the idea that this would never happen in a family that values eternal marriage or eternal families, in a home where, and they never come out and say this, right? If you're married in the temple and your children are born in the covenant, this will never happen. But what they say is no thinking parent or no parent who's concerned with the eternal consequences of their children would allow this to happen. So what we've got is these two interesting sub-messages, dog whistles, if you will, that we're sending out to parents that say, one, this won't happen if you're married in the temple, which makes it harder for me to see it if it's happening in my own home, right? But then also, it again makes it harder for you to come forward if it's happening in your home, because clearly you've fallen short in some area. Before we move on to the next slide, I want to make it clear that the talks that I read, of these 26 that I spent a lot of time with, messages were given and directed specifically to anyone within the sound of my voice who's engaging in this behavior. You need to stop now and go see your priesthood leaders. Okay, so I want to make clear that just because I don't focus on messages to perpetrators, that doesn't mean they weren't talked to. They just weren't. It was always that quick, if you're doing this, stop it and go see your priesthood leader. And that wasn't nearly as interesting to me, or I think as important to talk about, for me anyway. So the next one is speaking to the victims. One of the things that was most upsetting or frustrating to me was all messages, every message that was about sexual abuse or about abuse in general, was discussing children as victims. We never talked about adult women or adult men as victims, unless they were specifically talking about wife abuse. Okay? So they spoke often about little children being impacted by this and adults being impacted from abuse they lived through as children, but not once did the word rape appear. We never talked about this as a possibility of something that could be happening to adults, and I think that is a problem if we're looking at messages being sent, not just words being spoken. It, especially if you factor in the Richard G. Scott effect, which I'll talk about in a minute, it puts blame. It makes victims feel less victimized, less like maybe they had something, like they're innocent in this. So one of the other things they talked about is the most common message to victims was forgiveness. And probably most disturbing is forgiveness at the expense of justice. So this would be to victims, like, if you've done this, we want you come this night and repent. That's to the perpetrators. I wanted to make that clear. And then second, we have one of the most godlike expressions of the human soul is the act of forgiveness. And then Dallin H. Oaks goes on to read a letter from an adult woman who was a victim of abuse. And the last thing she says is, I have no right to hold on to it and demand justice. Yeah, that becomes, I'll go through a couple of biggest problems, which the number one problem we have here is anecdotes. Just, they should stop using them when discussing this topic. And then the last one, this is, so again, where we're focusing on children, abusive children will be part of the downfall of civilization, which also then became, it was tied into so many other things like abortion and divorce and pornography. So it becomes this one place where instead of choices that you make on your own, does that make sense? It gets tangled up with so many other things that are usually considered like more like agency related, and victims can hear these messages and not really be able to clarify that this is not my choice. I'm not responsible here, especially if you end up with, oh, Boyd K. Packard, there's your name, the Richard G. Scott effect, which is basically that Richard G. Scott gave these two talks that almost everybody knows about, where in the early 90s he talked about healing from sexual abuse, and his talk very specifically laid out that victims have some responsibility here. Now, thankfully, he gave that talk again in 2002 and took that section out, but still included this requirement for forgiveness. If we are talking about the general message that our leaders are sending to members of the church, to victims of abuse, and to priesthood leaders who are hearing this, and priesthood leaders are who, when they address victims, they say, go to your priesthood leader. They don't say, go to your young women's leader if you're a young woman. They say, go to your bishop or stake president. So if this is the message, this Richard G. Scott theme, that talk from the early 90s is going to, it's still there, right? If I Google it, when I type in abuse, it's the first thing that comes up. So that's a problem. It's this lingering effect that he has. So I just want to close with by talking about the anecdotes that we use. I don't know why we have to use stories to talk about these, but so one talk by President Packer opens with a little vignette, and I'm going to read it to you just because no one's going to believe me if I tell you that he talked about this unless I read it to you. So some years ago, Dr. Fawn Hunsaker, then president of the Southern States Mission, was invited to stay at the home of a member. He arrived after the children were in bed. He occupied the parents' bedroom and during the night heard the door open and the sound of little feet. A little boy, frightened by a bad dream, had come to his parents' bed for comfort. Sensing that something was different, the little boy felt Brother Hunsaker's face, so he spoke quietly to the child. The startled youngster said, "You're not my daddy." "No, I'm not your daddy." "Did my daddy say you could sleep here?" "Yes, your daddy said I could sleep here." With that, the little youngster crawled into bed with Brother Hunsaker and was soon asleep. Okay, so what we have here is a general authority trying to share this really sweet story about trusting little, about little children and how they trust, and accidentally, indirectly approving behavior that's completely inappropriate between an adult and a child. Okay. We use these anecdotes in order to share, personalize the stories, give some sort of feeling, emotion, pathos to it. But what we're doing is creating even more problematic behavior. The second one I want to share is from Richard G. Scott's talk in 2002, wherein he talks about an abuse victim who, after her own concerns were resolved by her faith in the healing power of atonement, one young woman who'd been severely abused by her father requested another interview with me. She returned with an older couple. I could sense that she loved the two very deeply. Her face radiated happiness. She began, "Elder Scott, this is my father. I love him. He's concerned about some things that happened in my early childhood. They are no longer a problem for me. Could you help him?" Now, on the surface, as we hear this story and as Elder Scott is sharing this anecdote, I'm sure it sounds like a really beautiful example of the atonement working and this woman finding healing. When we read deeper, or if you read it and are looking for the message that is really sent, one, we're putting the responsibility on the victim again to find forgiveness and to bring her abuser in so that he can feel better. But then also, that places, if I am in the audience and I am hearing this and I have been abused, I am now, again, listing that as like, this is the benchmark for me to be considered healed. I have to not only forgive my abuser, I have to now help them find something be right. And these talks, I gave these anecdotes because the anecdotes just kept jumping out at me, but there are examples throughout the talks wherein general authorities call on victims to handle it quietly and find a way to find forgiveness. And that's what we have then is indirectly through communication that's not, they're not sending a message that says hide this and victims fix it yourself, but we are sending that message through the way we talk about it. And it's, yeah, so that is what I found. That's my conclusion.
Thank you so much. Okay, Nancy.
Okay, I am going to be speaking a little bit about social media responses to blog posts that discuss stories or experiences of sexual abuse. One thing I've been very interested in is that whenever there's a blog post in the Bloggernacle about a controversial subject, there will typically be a great number of comments. And that's kind of how this rolls, and I'm sure that many of you are at least somewhat familiar with this. And with a controversial subject, there are going to be a lot of arguments and a lot of disagreement. One thing that's unusual about blog posts that deal with sexual abuse is that there's a lot less disagreement. Because one thing that happens is that so many, mostly women, but obviously sexual abuse can happen to people of any gender, is that many women have experienced sexual abuse and have their own terrible story, or a close friend or family member have a terrible story. And so this is not a... So there is a lot less arguing often in these blog posts in the comments. There's often a lot of disclosure of individuals' own sexual abuse. But what I want to focus on is in reading a lot of these kinds of blog posts and in looking at the comments, especially those who are trying to detract away from the original post or away from stories of abuse, is that they have a number of elements in common. And I think that what we're going to hear, if Deborah just told us about the institutional message, we're going to see ways in which the institutional messages filter down to ordinary members' responses when people disclose sexual abuse. And I think it's important to establish, you know, and Deborah and I didn't plan this in advance, but there is this connection. And so, you know, we can't just say that this is, you know, some sort of freak accident that happens. And so I've got five problems or don'ts when people disclose sexual abuse. And so these are kind of five common problems that I've observed. And so I'm just going to go through these now. So one of the first things is that people disbelieve abuse. And I think that doesn't happen a lot in blog post comments, but it does crop up. And ultimately, people disbelieve or downplay the seriousness of abuse, often because we're kind of working on this women as liars precept that we have in society, this kind of mode or trope of sexism that just kind of rears its ugly head again and again. And I believe that in, was it Salt Lake or in Idaho recently, there was a chief of police who made some kind of comment that, you know, most cases of reported sexual abuse were false or were lies. And of course, this is not true. Actual studies that try to determine false reporting show that somewhere between 2 and perhaps 8% of rapes are falsely reported. But between 2 and 8% is certainly not most. And certainly when people disclose sexual abuse, we need to hear and believe them and understand. So there is this kind of a response of disbelief or of downplaying the abuse if perhaps penetration was not involved. And I've seen this just this last week. I saw this. So that's the disbelieving is one one problem. And then another very common problem that we see in these blog comments is that when people are discussing not only an episode of sexual abuse or a series of episodes of sexual abuse, and trying to disclose that sexual abuse to bishops in the hope that the bishop will do something for them, and the bishop or the church leader mishandles that abuse. One thing that people often do is jump in and excuse the bishops because they're only human. And this comes up again and again. Bishops are only human. So you take the responsible party, the party with the power where, you know, a wrong, a very serious wrong was reported, and somehow we absolve that individual who has the authority in this situation of all responsibility because they are human. And that's something that crops up very, very quite frequently. And so that turns the bishop from someone who was involved perhaps in effectively a cover-up of abuse into a victim. You know, the bishop is another victim of being accused of something. And that's just something that many people feel should not happen. And so we have this sense of the bishop is human defense that crops up again and again. Okay. A third thing that happens is this persistence of the idea that sexual abuse is rare and that it's an anomaly, and a refusal to see that the church has created a system where sexual abuse can thrive. And so refusal to see this as a systemic problem and only as, you know, a rogue individual. Recently, when after the gold standard fiasco went down, I became interested in this topic, and I contacted Lavina Fielding Anderson, and she sent me everything she had. And she sent me three volumes of the Mormon Alliance, which had documented in the 90s, they have publications from 95 to 97, documenting abuse in the LDS Church. And when I was reading through some of the patterns that they had identified in the 90s, I mean, it was terrible because all of these stories and types of stories were exactly the kinds of things that I had been hearing for years in feminist circles. And so it can't really be an anomaly if the stories are the same from decade to decade. Also, and I'm sure this is going to come up with Lisa, you know, we have a very high rate of sexual assault in Utah compared with the rest of the country, you know, and these things are confirmed by the Center for Disease Control, so they're not angry feminists making up numbers and reasons to be angry. But there is this continually this idea that when abuse happens, when it's handled badly, that is rare. But in fact, with the number of stories I've heard, when the number of really bad stories compared to the number of really properly handled stories, you know, it seems like bad handling of a situation is kind of the norm. You know, I imagine if we were to take a quick poll of the room, you'd probably affirm that. I'm seeing nods. So there's this persistent, the idea that sexual abuse is rare, or the myth that sexual abuse is rare. There's always in the discourse, so I did what Deborah did too. I didn't go to the depth that she did, but I was looking through these different talks that represent that use the word abuse or sex abuse, and there's never any reference to sexual abuse as trauma. Never any reference to sexual abuse as trauma, and often when people are countering the problem of sexual abuse, they're never acknowledging the actual trauma that victims or survivors experience. And when we don't actually acknowledge the thing that they actually experience is trauma, then we're off the hook for all kinds of problems. The last thing that I want to just pick up on, which just very much following on from what Deborah just said, which is that some people counter stories of sexual abuse with the need for expressions of forgiveness, the idea that forgiveness counters the non-referenced trauma or something to that effect, and faith in the church's hotline to help the victim. When there's a fundamental misunderstanding that the hotline is there to limit the liability of the church and not actually to help the victim. And so I think that these are our sex abuse myths of in the Mormon world, and I hope that we can counter these narratives or these arguments when we hear them, because they do so much damage to isolate individuals who are already traumatized through sexual abuse. And that's kind of the summation of what I want to say. Thank you.
Some of you may know I recently graduated from a counseling program, and I'm going to be starting that. And one of the areas that I'm super interested in practicing in is the area of, you know, sexuality and Mormonism and the way that that intersects. And I'm also had about a dozen years of hearing women's stories over and over and over again. And as was mentioned, there are these themes that come up, and I feel like every time I hear a new story, I definitely recognize aspects of those stories, right? And I find that significant and interesting because I feel like we have sort of this category of things we know, and then a sort of this other category of things we think we know, but we don't really know, right? So in this category of things that I feel like we know, there have been really good studies done that show that women in Utah are at greater risk than most women in other states for sexual abuse. We know that. It's really well documented from multiple agencies. There's actually a new study just out done by a couple of nurses at BYU, and this study is kind of what ignited the whole rape at BYU controversy that's been big in the press lately. So the presentation at which that study was given sort of sparked all the other things that have been happening. So we know that. And one of the things that this study seemed to highlight was that women in Utah, we know this too, are more likely to be taking antidepressants and other drugs for mental illness, anxiety, depression, bipolar disorder, antipsychotics. And these women who are more likely to be either diagnosed with a mental illness or taking medicines that would be used, because some people don't like to self-disclose, right? That these women are more likely to be sexually abused. And that might feel a little backwards, like you take antidepressants because you were abused, but it seems to be both. It is both it's correlated that if you are mentally ill, you're more likely to be sexually abused in Utah. And that's true everywhere, but it's about twice as true in Utah. You're about twice as vulnerable in Utah as a mentally ill woman of being sexually abused than a mentally ill woman in most other states. So we know that there's this really strong correlation between Utah and women who are expressing mental illness or taking drugs for mental illness. And we know that sexual abuse is stronger in Utah. What we don't know, but seem to want to extrapolate, is that there is something about the church culture that creates this difference, right? And that is where, like, I feel like as a community, we need to figure out a way to study this. Like, what are the aspects of the things that we have been talking about earlier in the session, the way that sexual abuse is talked about, the way that we talk about doctrine and policy? What are the ways that this perpetuates sexual abuse for Mormon women? And that's something that just has not been studied. It does not exist. There is no data. And so what I have then is my experience of listening to these stories over and over and over again. And I feel like when I think about it, that it's sort of like I've been doing research for 12 years, but I just haven't written it down. You know, like having spent 12 years reading these stories over and over and over again, I know the patterns. I know I've seen it. I anticipate the next time I hear the story that it will have these elements, right? But nobody has quantified that. Nobody has done a qualitative study and then some quantitative studies in order to, you know, show that this is what is happening. And I feel like that sort of process is vital, right? Like, that is a vital process if we are going to get any sort of institutional change. And so then that got me thinking about, well, what are the ways that we might get institutional change, right? So we have the scandal option. The Catholic Church did that. That was fun for them. there's some ideas of like some internal grassroots change happening. In my position as the founder of FMH, I have had quite a few opportunities to meet with leaders of the church and the PR department, and I have put forth this pleading. Can we create more resources for women who have had experiences of sexual abuse? Like, and the response I always get is the brethren will never do that. They are never going to talk about sex. They're never going to say the sex word in public. And I got really excited when Mormons and Gays website came out. And I approached them. I'm like, can we do something like that for women and sexual abuse, where we have really good resources and it has the stamp of approval of the church on it, because there's so many of women that aren't going to reach out for resources that they don't feel like have been approved of. And again, the response is the brethren aren't going to ever do that. That's the response I get from employees of the church. So that might change, but I don't, you know, like right now, that's the sense of what I get is happening. There's also, you know, the thing we talk about, generational change. All the old men will die. Maybe some new men will come. Maybe something will happen. That's going to be slow. That might be what happens. There might not be a lot of change. And if there is, it could be very slow. Then there's the possibility of sort of some internal grassroots organizing on the ward levels. It seems unlikely because the anecdotes I hear over and over again are not, and my own experiences. I approached my bishop. I said, hey, I've been trained as a counselor. Let me talk to you about, and he's like, I know, I'm good. I mean, that's it, shut you down. I don't want to hear it from you. Just a profound lack of curiosity about what he could do to be more helpful. And the thing is like, we hear this excuse for bishops, oh, he's a good guy. That's what I would say about my bishop. He's a nice guy. But the position, the way that we do hierarchy and all these things doesn't create a lot of space for that kind of change. And so the thing I think about when I think about that kind of change is that the primary exists for exactly that reason. A bunch of women said, hey, we need something for the kids to do at church. And then a bunch of women started doing it. And then Brigham Young saw that they were doing it. He was like, okay, that's a good idea. We'll call it primary. Or I don't know if he came up with a primary. Probably not. But, right? So things like that have happened. I don't know that such a thing is possible anymore. And then there's obviously, you know, sort of external advocacy. Levina and, who else was working on that project? The co-authors?
Janice.
She's like, that's right. She's right there. Right? So, you know, like they attempted that, right? Here, we're going to make these... this compilation is very professionally edited, done, boom, and the result of that, we all know what happened for them. It wasn't good. And so then the other option, I guess, is a grassroots effort where we try to come up with resources. I've thought of, you know, approaching the Mormon Mental Health Association and saying, hey, let's make a resource page for women who are recovering from sexual abuse. It's not the same. There are a lot of women who aren't going to listen to or use that kind of a resource. But for the most part, those kinds of things don't exist. And so Having said that, like, one of the things I have want to talk about is the way that I think I guess after looking at this for 12 years and watching it over and over again, sorry, I got lost in my notes for a second. I think that, you know, those Mormon validated resources primarily are not going to exist anytime soon because we have untrained clergy, and that can result in abuse itself, where there is ecclesiastical abuse, or just the non-recognition of what abuse looks like. That is one of the most common themes that comes up in the stories that are told, is I went into the bishop, I told him about this rape experience, and he put me through the repentance process. I don't know how many times you've heard that story, but I've heard that story more times than I could even count. And then we have untrained and sort of unempowered child and young women, young men's leaders. The young women's leaders don't have offices in the church where they could sit down with young women, and the young women might feel safe to say, hey, this thing is happening to me, I don't understand. Like, there's no empowerment for them or training. We have no training for our primary teachers or our primary. And that's something that the Catholics have gotten really good at in the last decade. They train the heck out of their youth leaders. And there are all kinds of things in place in order to prevent any kind of things happening, at least at church. I've been very, like, my words are gone. I'm like, where are my words? So I think, the big problem that we have is that the culture of shame is so deeply embedded within the way that we talk about sex and the way that we talk about abuse and the way that we talk about everything. And that even includes family home evening, and, you know, that it is really hard for Mormons who are deeply invested in their identity as Mormons, deeply invested in their certainty of the truth, and that's part of their identity, that it's going to be incredibly hard to change the culture in a way that can lead us toward a more open discussion. Because, as you know, like, we probably all know shame is the big thing right now in the mental health field, right? So we probably all are kind of aware that the thing that feeds shame is silence and secrecy. And as a Mormon culture, we have a belief in the sacredness of silence and secrecy, right? There are things that are too sacred to be talked about. And sex is one of those things. And from a mental health perspective, secrets and silence are the absolute worst thing you can do for the health of the women and men who are being abused. That silence chokes them and suffocates them. And we, as a culture, have created sort of a holy aura around that. Oh, handle this quietly, or don't even handle it. Just forgive them before you even handle it, right? Like, this, it's too sacred to be discussed in public. It's too, you know, like, that sullies it. And so as long as we have this belief that is deeply embedded, that's going to keep compounding the shame and the secrecy and compounding the problem. And the thing about shame and the thing about secrecy and silence is that the only way to overcome it is to talk about it. And so the mechanism is so deeply embedded, that mechanism of secrecy is so embedded in the way we talk about our doctrine, and it's sort of this belief of sacredness in the secrecy, that creates a real big problem for getting an institutional response to this problem. And then that also feeds into the lack of belief, right? So women who do speak up are troublemakers, women who do speak up are liars, and women who do speak up are betraying their tribe. And the thing that we know in mental health about sexual abuse and the survive and be going from a victim to a survivor of sexual abuse is that children, men, women, all survivors of sexual abuse who are believed, who receive resources, who are supported, for the most part, have mental health outcomes that are similar to people who have not been abused. People who are silenced and disbelieved and ignored, or who are told to keep secrets, have mental health outcomes in which they have a lot of depression and anxiety and bipolar disorder and need psychotropic drugs. You know, and it becomes this cycle. And so I guess my ultimate argument is that there needs to be a shift in the way that we think about and talk about sexuality in Mormonism, in which it's not a shameful secret or even a sacred secret, and that as people who care about this, we really need to figure out, and I'm hoping that I, as a professional counselor, once I actually have a career, and maybe I can get some grant money, I can do this research, right? Like, because this research has never been done, and until it is, we're just speculating. I'm just saying, oh, I've read about a lot about this, right? Yeah. And that only has limited power for change.
Thank you. Okay, we got approximately 12 minutes for questions. And so when you got a question, all right, the line is forming, the queue is going. Here we go. And then when you have a question, you can give it to the whole panel, or if it's for a specific person, just name them.
All right. I was just wondering, is there anything in any of the instructions to the bishop telling them that they should or that they need to take incidences of abuse to the police? And if not, what do you think would have to change for that to be in their instructions and to be expected and to be something where if they weren't doing it, then the church would be liable.
So, is this okay? So, first of all, that's what the hotline is supposedly for. In Utah, we have a law that says that clergy do not have to report. So if there are men, and I just looked this up like last week because a thing came up. So in most states, clergy would be mandatory reporters where they would have to register a complaint to, like, the Department of Child and Family Services or to the police or something. But in Utah, clergy do not have to do that. And so you can imagine to the extent to which that fuels and provides a cover for all of this.
Additionally,
the hotline is aware of how that differs state by state.
Yeah.
So if someone calls into the hotline,
they know. Yeah, you're talking to lawyers. And so additionally, the messages that were given, like the most recent one, says specifically, serious abuse can also benefit from professional help. So what we're doing is directing victims who hear these talks and priesthood leaders who are listening to them that only serious abuse needs professional help. So what needs to change is we have, as an institution, our church is obsessed with legal liability. And I know that's what happens when you're a corporation, but we're maintaining that obsession at the expense of victims.
Has there been any effort to change the legislation here?
Yes. Oh, yes. I'm sorry.
No, I'm
sorry.
Luck. curious.
Not that I'm aware of.
Is it a claim of sexual assault or an actual report of sexual assault? I just wanted a clarification on that on the law. Like if someone's reported that they've been raped.
To a clergyman?
Yeah.
To your clergy, there's no legal requirement to report.
Okay. But if they even it actually happened, they don't have to either?
Well, it doesn't matter. I mean, anytime I come to my bishop or to a stake president and say this happened, they're not legally required to report it. They call the hotline, and the hotline knows what Utah's laws are. And you're talking to, like, your bishop, I'm sure, is a really nice guy. My bishop's an insurance salesman. My stake president's an accountant. Richard G. Scott is a mechanical engineer. Like, these are not people trained to deal with this. And they're getting advice from lawyers.
Okay, question.
Sorry, I got angry there. I apologize.
Several decades ago, as a missionary in Germany, I encountered a woman from another European country who told me she wanted absolutely nothing to do with the church because her father had molested her as a child, and then he had joined the church and had been forgiven and repented, allegedly, and had been called, been given a calling, and she just couldn't deal with that. And I completely get that. I understand that. But something you said, Deborah, and you mentioned it too, this idea of, it sounded almost denigrating, the idea of encouraging somebody to seek forgiveness. And yet, to me, that's a core gospel principle. So I'm interested in how you see those two things not meshing together. I mean, I understand not telling a woman, just forgive him and move on with your life. I understand that. That's not appropriate. But it sounded like you weren't encouraging it at all. And what is your idea of somebody that really is repentant? I mean, I'm interested to hear your thoughts about that.
I think I hear you.
Without sounding like the creepy old white dude here.
Way to go. Jeez.
Okay.
So for me specifically, since I think I'm the one who kind of hit that one the hardest. Sorry. Forgiveness, I have no problem with our church leaders encouraging perpetrators to try to make reparations, to try to, you know, to apologize personally and attempt to get forgiveness. What I have a problem with is the message that we're sending is that forgiveness on the part of the victim is mandatory for you to be considered healed or for you to be following the doctrine of Jesus Christ. So that's a huge problem for me in the theme. Institutionally, like your example, I have a real problem with the fact that we don't, I don't like the idea of publicly outing people, but when there's a perpetrator in our midst and we keep that so quiet, that's a very dangerous thing. And it's hard for me to accept the idea of like forgive and forget when we're still, like when we're placing them as a scout leader. That, like, so I think it's a real delicate balance for me.
So I mean, as a mental health professional, I have worked with both perpetrators of sexual abuse and victims of sexual abuse. And most perpetrators are also victims. Mm-hmm. All the perpetrators I've worked with personally are also victims. And I would say that as with most gospel principles, forgiveness towards yourself is generally, I think, what is most healing for both perpetrators and victims of sexual abuse. Because every victim of sexual abuse I have ever worked with has had a lot of self-blame. That there was a lot of, like, I somehow should have stopped this, I somehow should have known, something. Like, there's some part of me that is responsible for this, what happened to me. And, or I was unworthy of, in some way, and that's why this happened to me, right? There's something wrong with me, that's why this happened to me. And so the healing that comes from forgiveness, I think, has to start internally toward oneself. And that's where the forgiveness really starts. And there is not going to be any forgiveness of anyone else. It's when Jesus talks about judge not so that you're not judged, right? I think that we often think about, if I judge other people, then God is going to judge me with the same stick, right? I think it goes the other way. As long as I'm judging myself, as long as I'm not forgiving myself, I will be judging everyone else and not forgiving everybody else, right? And we create our own hell. God doesn't have to judge us. We've done it already. We've judged us. We've condemned us. And we live in this state of pain because we don't believe in our own worthiness, in our own divine worth.
And if we look at the context in which forgiveness is generally talked about in these sorts of contexts, there is generally no justice whatsoever for victims, no acknowledgement of the problem, no apology, no attempt for reparations made. But then the person who has been most harmed is then said, it is your job to do this now. When there is, and often there is a timeline put on that, as though all of this whole thing is their fault, yeah. And it's their job to make it right.
Yeah.
And that is not the case. And if they never forgive, I think God will forgive them for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm one of the co-authors of the Mormon Alliance's 1995 volume on child sexual abuse.
Good work, Janice.
Nice and, work.
Levina actually did most of the work. I wrote the introduction and helped with the editing. And after doing that volume, it was so moving to me, and an idea became very clear to me, which I would like to share with you. The next year, I gave a paper at Sunstone, which I called Sacrificing the Children, Why the Church Won't Fight Child Sexual Abuse. Basically, I'll give it to you as quickly as I can. Sexual abuse is an abuse of power that denies the agency and violates the personhood of the victim. And sexual abuse is particularly bad because it's done in a sexual way, and one's sexual identity is very much a part of the core personality. The church has developed a system of governance which is extremely authoritarian and hierarchical, in which it is assumed that leaders are always right and must be unconditionally obeyed. The perpetrators of child sexual abuse in the Mormon church are usually priesthood holders, quite often fathers, other authority figures, and leaders. And so what we have in the church is a system which puts on a different level the very abuse of power which is perpetrated on, we talked about children, on a child. And so the church won't fight it, because to root out what is being done here would require them to undo their whole system of power.
Amen.
And so,
and we see that in the messages. We see that in the conference talks. It's directed to men all the time, and it's constantly referenced in the connection to their priesthood authority. And
right.
And it's horrifying.
And what I say is that what they are doing is they are making the image of the church more important than the lives of children.
Yep.
Okay, we have time for one more. I'm sorry. It's 4:44. I do apologize.
Thank you so much. And I only will take about 10 or 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
First of all, what a hard act to follow. Thank you so much for the work that you did on that. Bishop Roulette is heard often. I think in something this sensitive, your chances of getting someone good are less than 1%, so you can just about forget that. The legal status of a confessional is something that every woman should be aware of, and that is she's not going to get any legal help at all from the bishop, and the bishops are counseled to stay away from any possibility of testifying against or for either of the parties in an abuse. A significant difference between the Mormon church and all the other churches, and we're really so much alike, we're 99% alike, but is the loss of boundaries that children have and adults have. The interview process that was started with the home missionaries in the 1800s and has developed into youth interviews and temple recommend interviews destroy boundaries. And if you're looking for a point to start your research, I think that would be the significant difference. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I believe that is all. Let's give a big round of applause to Nancy, Lisa, and Deborah.